Are we recording?
You're listening to
Source News
on 4EB Community Radio, presented by Griffith University students.
Hello and welcome to the Source News. I'm Rosie.
I'm Jonah.
I'm Harry.
And I'm John.
We begin today by acknowledging the Yagara and Turrbal people as the traditional custodians of the land on which we broadcast.
We've got a jam-packed show today. Rosie investigates how unions use industrial action to spark political change.
Harry highlights one of the biggest events in Queensland schoolboy sport.
Jonah goes behind the scenes of one of the most famous celebrations in the Brisbane Festival.
Teo reflects on the tourism industry's growing impact on the Gold Coast.
And John explores Brisbane's emerging independent rap scene. So don't go anywhere, because it's time for another great episode of The Source News.
You're listening to The Source News.
The Source News. Future journalists.
Queensland teachers held their first statewide strike in over 15 years back in August, walking out of schools to protest staff shortages, excessive workloads, and poor working conditions. This strike is just one of the most recent examples of how industrial action is being used to leverage bargaining power against the government. Rosalie Chapman looks at what this event can tell us about successful collective action.
What you just heard was from the Queensland Teachers Union strike in Brisbane in August of this year. Over 50,000 teachers across the state walked out of their classrooms, with Brisbane's workers protesting in front of the Queensland Parliament House due to the union's ongoing negotiations with the government.
State schools! State schools! State schools!
This marks the first QTU strike in 16 years, with the union saying that they were pushed to industrial action after government offers failed to meet their minimum negotiation requirements. The union argues that the lack of adequate support of resources, disregard for occupational safety, and teacher workload are now at unsustainable levels. Harley Nightingale, a local teacher from South Brisbane, says she attended the strike because she feels she cannot provide her students with the education they deserve if something doesn't change.
So we're already seeing how negatively it's affecting our students, and in reverse that's infecting us as the teachers and not knowing what we can do, because there's so much we can't do. Showing up for teachers and being able to give them that resource will mean that we'll have good teachers. I think sitting here and yelling at teachers as if they're glorified babysitters is a bit kind of ridiculous.
Harley's concerns reflect the frustrations of thousands of teachers who march for better pay and working conditions, but the Queensland government insists it's listening and reworking previous negotiations.
The really big question is, John Paul Langbrook, can you hear us now?
Education Minister John Paul Lambrook says Queenslanders have seen the government continue to negotiate with the Queensland Teachers Union in good faith, and they remain at the table to finalise an agreement that ensures teachers are well remunerated and respected. Even so, the government and QTU have failed to reach an agreement after an additional 3 months. The ongoing stalemate highlights the uncertainty surrounding the current negotiation, but also highlights why the union turned to industrial action. While we can't be sure of the result of the strike, the collective action effectively disrupted classrooms and demonstrated the strength of workers, especially when supported by parents. QTU's president, Cressa Richardson, had this to say at the strike.
I've got to say, I'm not much of a religious person, but if we have a little bit of a look around, we are making history and it's a little bit of a religious moment. This is a teacher voice that cannot be denied.
Beyond the bargaining table, academics argue that QTU's focus isn't just on pay, but on how the system is failing both our students and our teachers. Anna Hogan, an associate professor in QUT's School of Education, says it's important for parents to remember that the public school system is not the fault of an individual teacher, but of a larger systemic issue.
When you think about the history of teacher strikes, often they're around pay and conditions. And I think very much this time, yes, of course, pay is always an issue, but conditions more so. One of the things that is really key in all this is that often teachers themselves are blamed for you know, low quality teaching or not being resilient enough in the classrooms. And I think we need to keep putting the pressure back onto this idea that it's not an individual failure, it's a systemic failure which needs systemic change.
That was Anna Hogan, finishing off Rosalie Chapman's report on the effectiveness of union power.
The Source. Piping hot news served fresh to you.
Up next, it's one of the biggest rivalries in Queensland schoolboy sport, Terrace vs Nudgee. Every year, thousands pack the sidelines for a match that's about more than just rugby. The recent clash once again drew huge crowds, and Harry Jan has been speaking to coaches, supporters and students about why this game captures so much attention.
It's the biggest game on the Queensland schoolboy rugby calendar, and this year's Terrace vs Nudgee game was no different. An estimated 2,000 spectators piled in to an over-capacity Ross Oval at Nudgee College, drawing 10 times the attendance of a normal schoolboy rugby game. Students from both schools made their support heard and doing their best to get their side the victory, with loud chants being heard from well before kickoff all the way until the final whistle. But what makes this rivalry so different from any other schoolboy game? Terrace rugby coach and teacher James Turner explains that it's all about history, stretching back more than 100 years.
History, I think, because obviously St. Joseph's, both schools are called St. Joseph's. That's because we started off as one school and now there's two. When Terrace became too big to have a boarding school. So I really think there's a long-standing and over 100-year history. Of course, the first game was in 1891, and, you know, that's nearly over 130 years ago. So over 130 years of history is what makes it so special.
On the other side of the rivalry, former Nudgee Dean of Students and rugby coach Anthony Connellan says that the game for the students is not only about winning, but also teaching them important values.
For me, over time, like when I was coaching 15, 20 years ago, like I, you know, really loved the battle and loved the sport. But when I became, so I was Dean of Students, was my position. For me then, my desire for the boys was to see more than just the result. Like I wanted them to have respect for their opposition. So I could see that for 120, 130 years, Nudgee and Terrace boys, when they left school, became great mates and worked together and lived together and thrived, you know. So I wanted the boys at school to embrace that a bit and have that really healthy respect. So when we're on the field, we're fighting as hard as we can, but the minute full-time whistle is, then we become friends. So for me, there was a bit of a humility, respect piece for each school.
For old boys, the rivalry is just as meaningful. Jeffrey Lawson has been watching Terrace and Nudgee face off for more than 30 years. These days, he says the best part is sharing it with his two sons, who now attend Terrace.
Fortunate enough over the years to attend a lot of Terrace First 15 games, both at Ross Oval, out at Nudgee, but also at the Tennyson playing fields, and it gets my blood boiling and very excited about the opportunity of going out there and watching the first 15 with my two boys. I was fortunate enough that when my eldest son Oliver started grade five, Harry Wilson, the current Wallaby captain, was also captain of the Terrace First 15, and they played out at Tennyson and actually won a very close game in testing conditions at the final bell, so brings back some great memories.
And it's not just the players and coaches who feel the intensity of the day. Even at the canteen, the Terrace Nudgee clash is the busiest game of the year, with staff working flat out as crowds line up for food and drinks. Canteen worker Margaret O'Donnell says the atmosphere is unlike anything else.
It's always the busiest day of the year for us. You can really feel the buzz around the grounds. People just aren't here just for the rugby. They're catching up with old mates. Families are out in force, and the line at the canteen, it doesn't stop all day.
When the final whistle blew at Ross Oval, it was Nudgee who came out on top, sealing another chapter in Queensland's biggest schoolboy rugby rivalry.
This will be the final margin. Nudgee College.
Congratulations to Nudgee College, taking the win.
Well, the Battle of the Colours finishes again in favour of Nudgee College.
For the ninth time in 10 years.
At 38-31.
That was an awesome story from reporter Harry Jan, spotlighting some local Brisbane sport. Don't go anywhere, because we'll be right back with some more great stories.
For the latest from Brisbane and the Gold Coast, you're listening to The Source News on 4EB Global Digital.
Coming up, we have two fantastic local stories about Gold Coast tourism industry and Brisbane's local rap scene, so don't go anywhere.
Southeast Queensland has plenty to offer in the last leg of the year. Though Brisbane Festival has just wrapped up, plenty of events are still to come before the year's end.
Running from October 22nd until November 9th, the Unmissable Melt Festival celebrates the iconic queer arts and culture of Brisbane. Community radio station 4ZZZ joins the festival to discuss the power of community-led media on queer representation through broadcast radio at the Brisbane Powerhouse on November 1st.
And it's a big moment for country music fans as the Groundwater Music Festival is on the Gold Coast in only a few weeks. The three-day event features over 30 Australian artists, and best of all, it's completely free.
And if you didn't get a chance to take the little ones over the school holidays, you're still in luck, as Bluey's Bowl will be running until March 2026.
It's wonderful to see the reception Bluey has gotten on the world stage. An Australian cartoon set in our own city is popular across the globe. How about that?
Though it has come and gone for another year, Riverfire is another giant of Brisbane culture. And with the city's colourful decor of public art going back into storage, we look back on Riverfire. Since 1998, Riverfire has attracted Brisbaneites to the riverbanks, pubs, bars and rooftops, and has been broadcast to televisions across the country. To look back on this year's event, Jonas Slope has more.
The dazzling Riverfire has lit up Brisbane skies and television screens across the country since 1998, becoming a calendar mainstay in that time. From F-111s to Super Hornets, a show of RAAF planes has accompanied the fireworks. In combination with a killer soundtrack, the roar of jets and the pop of fireworks, Riverfire is an audio-visual sensation. This year's show kicked off Brisbane Festival with a bang. More fireworks, cameras, events, and even new technology. Channel 9 producer Leo Flynn, who has been in charge of the Riverfire broadcast for 16 years, provides some insight into this year's event.
We're doing something very different for us, and for the first year ever, we're putting a drone up in the air to do fireworks, which is also different for the fireworks company because they're going to have drones that'll fire fireworks off the drones.
Backed by popular demand, drones have become key to Riverfire and the larger Brisbane Festival. Extending to late September, the Skylaw Light Show celebrates Brisbane, from Yuggera and Turrbal culture to modern displays of colourful decadence. Though the lights are relatively new, the flyover of RAAF jets has long been a staple of Riverfire.
In the early days, we started off doing, I think it was about a 7-camera shoot back in the day when the F-111s used to do a dump and burn flyover that used to start fireworks.
Months of work is involved in the making of Riverfire, and not just for the Brisbane Festival team. For Brisbane's Riverside bars, Riverfire is among the busiest of nights. Jeff Cubley, who has been the events manager at the Plough Inn in South Bank for 3 years, provides some behind-the-scenes insight.
So normally we like to lock in the event at the start of the year when it's a little bit quiet, so generally around that February-March period for us. We lock in key events that we want to do later on in the year. I'll reach out to suppliers to lock in any additional assets that we need.
For many, Riverfire provides an excuse for a much-needed night out.
From 6 till 10, we do a Level 1 exclusive event, cocktail style, and that's a food and beverage package. And then we've just got an array of tapped beers and ciders, some wines and some cocktails. Fireworks start at 7 o'clock, so we normally see a bit of a lull at the bar. People generally go downstairs, say, in that plaza area, because that gives them a better view of the Brisbane skyline.
Riverfire is a celebration of the River City. As sparklers pour into the river from the Story Bridge, South Bank parklands are awash with colour. Drones paint the sky as jets roar overhead, and family and friends gather alongside their fellow Brisbaneites to watch the show unfold.
for people that get there and spend their whole day down at South Bank or up on Kangaroo Point Cliffs or somewhere down at Howard Smith Wharves to look at the Story Bridge, whether you see the South Bank side of it and all the fireworks that go off from the top of the buildings.
No matter how you watched River Fire this year, from the riverside in South Bank to Wilson's Lookout in the valley, from the Howard Smith Wharves to the Star Casino, there were no bad angles for this event.
My producer, Marguerite, and I actually go for a walk around the city and South Bank and Kangaroo Point, so we then are able to have a look at where we want to set up our camera position.
River Fire highlights our city.
There's a couple of draw cards for it. I mean, obviously, it's a great family event if you want to go to see the fireworks live.
So, perfect place. We're right in front of the casino. The fireworks are just over the river there, so a perfect view for it. We've got a live DJ on that night as well, so your entertainment is all sorted. So if you did want to kick on, you can certainly do that. Otherwise, in South Bank, there's lots of other places to go if you wanted to stop off for dessert or a couple of drinks at another bar.
Though River Fire has wrapped up for another year, I'm sure we'll see you along the banks next year.
Well, that definitely makes me excited for next year's River Fire. Jonah Slope with that report.
The Source. Piping hot news served fresh to you.
As summer approaches, the buzzing streets of the Gold Coast are filled with smiling, sunburnt faces and the shine of tourist sweat. But while the coast thrives on these visitors, it must also deal with the negative impacts. Taya Kalpo reports on the two sides of the tourism coin.
It's about the vibe, Alex.
It's nature.
Barbecue King prawns, Alex.
Dear Thorsten, where I live, we get up and Gold Coast.
Waves crash against endless stretches of golden sand. The sun glistens over surfboards while roller coasters roar and music spills from the bars. The Gold Coast is Australia's playground. But beneath the shimmer, not everyone's smiling. This is what the locals think of the guests.
Hate them. I don't know what to say. Yeah, not a fan really. It's an essential part of being on the Gold Coast, isn't it? Like it's a holiday place.
Gold Coast is built on tourism. It'd be a sad and lonely place without tourists. They bring people, it's an injection to the economy. There's all sorts of energy and a good vibe when there's like events and, you know, in summer and all of that sort of stuff. So
most of them are very badly mannered. I think our economy depends too much on them.
Whether positive or negative, the history of the Gold Coast tourism dates back decades. The professor of practice for the Griffith Institute for Tourism of Griffith University, Daniel Gushwind, explains why the city is so special.
In the 1950s and around that time, the Gold Coast, with its warm weather and year-round attractiveness, became a sort of a quintessential holiday destination. To this day, the beaches and the natural attractiveness of the coastline is still a very prominent feature. Of course, since then, more has been added. You know, the accommodation infrastructure, the attractions that have been built, the theme parks, all of the things that go with entertaining.
Daniel explains that the benefits of tourism can be felt by locals.
Educational infrastructure, all of that is also attractive to residents. So I think it has enhanced a somewhat unique lifestyle opportunity for people who enjoy this, and the inflow of new residents demonstrates just how attractive the Gold Coast has become.
Beyond the beaches and bright lights, the Gold Coast wild side is feeling the pressure. Tourism might power the city's economy, but it can also take the toll on the environment, a side often hidden from the postcards. GECCO, the local Environment Council Association, is trying to change that. Its advocate and campaigner, Lois Levy, explains how visitors are impacting the coast's fragile ecosystems.
We should be thinking about policies to control that situation. We don't really want huge numbers of people going through those areas. Often there's litter, people go off the track and wreck the bush, that sort of thing. Where there's swimming holes, there's lots of people who swim in the freshwater swimming holes and they've got sunscreen on, so it pollutes the holes, they leave rubbish around, they have drinking parties and broken glass, and the tracks in and out often get trashed as well. And of course it disturbs the wildlife that live in that area.
Lois says that a good way to lessen the negative impacts of tourism is to promote nature-based travel.
They've got a big push on at the moment for promoting what they call nature-based tourism, which is supposed to be small groups of people going in and perhaps some of them being involved in what they call citizen science, surveying for animals or plants, or planting or weeding.
Lois thinks that nature-based tourism could be the solution, or at least part of it. She shares that even though it sounds good, it is not easy to implement. At the moment, Galkos doesn't have a system to control the numbers. Lois shares that tour guides running the tours should be well-educated, but they often aren't. While groups like Gecko fight to protect the coast's natural beauty, locals are left to decide what kind of future they want for their home.
Considering that I'm an immigrant, I don't mind them, tourists. It depends. Some can be a little bit arrogant, some be very, very open-minded. It just depends. There's lots and lots of tourists, so it varies. But yeah, I think it's good to meet different cultures, hear their stories and why they are here, and what are they after? What do they want to experience in Australia? So yeah, definitely very positive about them. You can always have bad eggs, but you also have the good eggs, so yeah.
I love that they come and visit and bring in the dosh for the Gold Coast.
Yeah, they're great. I live here, so I work in hospitality, so they make an income for me.
Just one of the many ways tourists are viewed on the Gold Coast. Tea Kalpo with that report.
For the latest from Brisbane and the Gold Coast, you're listening to The Source News on 4EB Global Digital.
Hip-hop in Brisbane isn't just happening in the clubs or on big stages. It's built from the ground up in the heart of the city. Reporter John Harding visits a local South Bank studio where a new wave of independent rap is gaining momentum. Enter the E to the R-V-E.
Inside Brisbane's Bass 8 studio, the walls rumble with bass and bars. It's here that producers and rappers Nerve and Smack are carving out an independent sound that's putting their city on the map.
Check it, check it. Oh, that's crazy. That sounds nuts. I'm definitely tracking on that.
Bass 8 is more than just a studio. It's a hub for Brisbane's rap scene. Can you tell me how Bass 8 got started?
I guess it started from us meeting and making music together for ages, and we were both sort of self-sufficient artists that produced and recorded ourselves. And so us linking up and having a studio together just made it easier. Do you want to add anything?
Yeah. So for us, the studio is where we can sort of provide a platform for the local up-and-coming artists to create music and have it professionally mixed and mastered, to an industry standard, and, a place for us also to express ourselves and create. And I'd like to offer that sort of opportunity to the, younger guys who are trying to create a career within the Brisbane music industry.
Both Nerve and Smack juggle two roles, not just running the studio, but making music themselves. So how does being both rappers and producers shape the way you approach music here?
It's good for us in the sense that, like, as rappers that produce, we know how to communicate with each other when we want something done on a track, and the less time spent communicating and the more succinct your communication is, the quicker stuff gets done. It gives us both, like, a more rounded view of everything, and also having done shows, done tour managing, done all this stuff, it's like we know that people need live versions of what they have. We know what sounds good on a club system, on a PA system, on a festival system, because we've done it ourselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would say that it makes it easy to bridge the gap between, the two sides of the music, between the vocal and the instrumental. We've done it before. I was rapping before I was producing, so I find that makes it easy to work with people who are in the same position.
The process of making a track at Bass 8 often starts simple. A beat, a few bars, and builds from there. Can you walk me through a typical session here?
I'd like to just chop it up and talk for a little bit. Maybe listen to a bit of music for inspiration, you know, see what the artist's been listening to lately, or listen to some of their demos. Usually I'm looking through samples and I just play through them, and then I see what the artist, sort of tell if somebody actually likes the sound or something.
You gotta like read their mind a little bit.
Yeah, you can kind of just see like a bit of a reaction, and then I just start chopping it up and doing all the production, and then I like to try to push them to like start recording as soon as possible.
Because then you know what they're going for.
Probably finish the track, probably send them a little demo, do a little quick mix at the end, and that's a session, you know? Mm.
But being independent isn't without challenges. No label backing, no big budgets, just hustle.
I didn't have anywhere that I was like, when I was starting out, I was like, oh, I really want to go record there. It was like, you either record in your closet or you record in someone else's closet, or you build a studio or make it yourself. Like the first time I ever got playlisted was because we played a show in Sydney and the guy from Spotify was in the crowd. And then they started giving us mad love on Spotify. But that would never happen at a show in Brisbane. I think if we never left Brisbane to at least do shows and collaborate, like, we wouldn't be where we are.
For Nerve and Smack, Bass 8 is just the beginning. The future of Brisbane rap has been written right here, one track at a time. Where do you see Bass 8 and Brisbane rap in 5 years?
I could see us getting into like artist management and all that side of stuff in the next 5 years, or for me personally at least. For example, what I've been working on, I'm doing this youth detention music program at the moment, which is facilitated by Dimes of Nature from 4TL Music.
If the next 5 years goes like our last 6 months, I think things are going to be coming up pretty Millhouse.
Yeah,
that's what I would say.
From a small room in Brisbane, Bass 8 is making a big noise, proving that independent rap can stand tall on its own.
So John, you've been hanging around in Brisbane's hip-hop scene this week, yeah?
Yeah, as you just heard, I dropped into this little independent studio that a lot of rappers are using. Not just local guys either, from all over Oz and the UK even. It's not a big flash place, but they're punching above their weight with the tracks they're making.
That's so cool. What's it like inside? I'm picturing messy cables, maybe a dodgy old couch in the corner.
Yeah, you've pretty much summed it up, actually. There's Def's couple old couches and a few too many plug boards, and a little Red Bull fridge just to keep everyone amped up. But the energy's unreal, producers making beats, rappers running through verses in the booth, and everyone's just bouncing ideas around.
That's great. All right, well, that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to stories produced by Griffith University on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people. Tomorrow afternoon at 4, join hosts Brianna McGowan, DeRay Arrow, Ash Shrivington, and Khan Yu for another edition of The Source News. Brianna will be looking at the TikTokification of literature. Ash questions if young artists can afford to keep writing. Dara explores the challenges arising from the decreasing support of young creative. And Khan looks at the ethics and necessity of DLC and early access in video games. That's The Source News, tomorrow afternoon at 4 on 4AB Global Digital.